History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. As long as some of us are willing to take a little initiative and ask some questions, then to be patient enough to listen as long-buried memories start to filter back to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Earlier this week in Provo, Utah, a memorial service for a 101-year-old veteran featured his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, but also had many watching live from overseas in tribute to a man whose inspired act of kindness more than 70 years ago really did change the world. I'm talking about the Berlin Candy Bomber, Colonel Gail Halverson, who passed away last week. Our conversation with Hal, or Uncle Wiggly Wings, as he's revered in Germany, has long been one of the most listened to episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. If you pull up that web address now, you'll find a YouTube link to the entire memorial service for this humble hero of the Berlin airlift after World War II. Let's listen to a brief excerpt right now from his daughter, Denise.
We know our Heavenly Father brought him home at the time that was right. His mission on earth will continue in our hearts forever as he starts his new mission in heaven. His example is permanent. Uncle Wiggly Wings passed away peacefully and unexpectedly, surrounded by family on February 16, 2022. He taught us all the importance of attitude, gratitude, and service before self. Dad had the gift of a positive attitude, quick wit, and even more than that, a way to make every person feel special and that he knew them. He expressed gratitude for everything and taught us that through small acts of kindness, we can bring miracles into the lives of others. He is a man of action, adventure, and faith. Every night, even at 101 years old, he knelt with a struggle by his bed to pray. And one of my sweetest memories is hearing him pray so many nights. He could not sit still. He always looked for problems to solve. The bigger, the better. Hard work and perseverance win, no matter the odds. By small and simple things are great things brought to pass. We will miss him dearly. The world needs more heroes like Hal.
Indeed, it does. One way to carry on his legacy is by supporting the Gail S. Halverson Aviation Education Foundation. I have that info for you online as well. But some of you haven't heard his story before, and we want to take some time to listen to it as he told it today. We'll hear more from the memorial service later and conclude with Gail Halverson reading a poem that he wrote in the cockpit more than 75 years ago. But let's begin with where his love of aviation began. As a boy growing up on a Utah farm.
Working out in the field and throwing hay up in the hay wagon or thinning sugar beets, see an airplane come out through the blue sky and head up north to Idaho. And I'd stop and watch, and Dad said, well, you watch long enough, get back to work. And I was enthralled with airplanes from the beginning, so that was in my blood. The contrast was the farm work every day, and it was a good life, a really good life. I don't know how I could have had a better, more love and hard work and good lessons from a dad, good dad and mom. In 1941, before the war started, I competed with a bunch of guys from Salt Lake, Ogden, and Northern Utah for a flight scholarship. We had about 140 going to ground school, and they gave 10 scholarships. Well, I memorized everything being in the farm, so I got a free ride to get a private pilot license, me and 10 other guys. We didn't have any money, but we pulled up $50 a piece, and that's $500 and bought an airplane. It was a Franklin 55 horsepower engine with single ignition. That means if the ignition quits, you're a glider. So you learn to look out for emergency landing places. So I had a great time with that, and we got going, and Pearl Harbor came along, and of course we signed up and got in the Army Air Corps. But that's how I got started to fly, and I loved it. I got a lot of time didn't have any money to buy gas at that airplane. Spent my $50 on buying the airplane with other guys. So I had a really good buddy, Conrad Steffen, in Tremont, in Utah. He wanted to see what flying like was like. I said, well, I'm an expert. I got 35 hours. I'll show you how to do it. And so I gave him a ride, and he bought all the gas. So I flew a lot because he had a pretty good bank account. So we did a lot of flying together. I sure enjoyed Conrad Steffen.
Well, and you mentioned then Pearl Harbor happened, and then you ended up in the Army Air Corps after that. What do you remember about that day and how that news hit you, that all of a sudden your country has been attacked and the world has changed a little bit? Do you remember how you found out?
Yes, I was listening to car radio. I even had a radio in those days. good for radio. I love it. I love radio. But just the news broke up and the man came in. I thought they was doing one of these crazy shows, you know. I just didn't believe it. The Japanese, clear over there from Japan, would be bombing Pearl Harbor. It was beyond my belief. And then I thought, well, I'm glad I got a pilot license. I know I won't be. So I felt sorry for the guys slugging on the ground, our buddies that was part of the team. But I always wanted to fly. So I remember it. I just didn't believe it for a while. So I got a local radio broadcast that said it's true, that's underway. And so we were very much concerned then for the future. At that time, of course, the real heroes for me were the RAF pilots defending Great Britain. The guys that are flying day and night, going up at night to intercept the German bombers. I was just enthralled with those. And Chesley Peterson was a guy that lives not in Utah, not too far. He'd enlisted in the RAF quite a bit earlier. And he added another dimension, knowing the Utah guy was out there flying the RAF before Pearl Harbor. So they were my ideal. And when I signed up for aviation cadet training, and when we got to San Antonio, Texas for pre-flight, they had a notice on the board. It said, who wants to train with the RAF? And man, I ran in right quick and said, hey, I want to train with the RAF. They said, well, okay, we'll talk to you about it. And the Brits were training their pilots in the States during the bombing. Of course, they had more room in Canada and the United States. So I ended up in a flight training, RAF training in Miami, Oklahoma. That's how I got into the business and ended up with the Royal Air Force as a fighter pilot. When I got sent back to the Army Air Corps, they needed cargo guys. And that was a blow. But anyway, I really enjoyed my time flying the transport business in lots of parts of the country, and that got me into Berlin Airlift, so that's not all bad.
Was there ever a point, as you're training, and you say your heroes were the guys defending Great Britain and all those Spitfires and the mosquito bombers and everything that they were flying over there, was there ever a point as you're pursuing these aviation dreams that you thought, you know, I might be risking my life here?
Well, growing up on the farm, I used to try to ride my brother's horse. His horse was beyond my raider skill level, and when he'd take off, I'd ride his horse. So I always had a feeling of maybe pushing the envelope a little bit there. I had no real fear of flying. A few times in the air, I questioned that decision, but I just knew that I was going to fly no matter what happens. And I had confidence in the mechanics and the equipment, and if you end up being a glider, there must be a place to land it somewhere, miss the neighbor's house and land in the field. No, I didn't ever really have any apprehension about getting up in the airplane.
Well, that's the second time that's come up, that engine-powered aircraft could become an engineless aircraft and you could become a glider. And it's probably a little easier to accomplish that in that Franklin you had at first than a big cargo plane. Were there some times in your career where you had to deal with those kind of situations where you lost engine power?
Yes. Taking off out of Rio de Janeiro one day and looked out there, and all of a sudden, my right engine was engulfed in flames. I mean, it was just burning. I was in the Rio de Janeiro harbor, had hardly any altitude, and there was a big fire going on. But it went through the regular procedure, feathering the engine, stopping the engine, putting out the fire extinguisher to that engine, just pull the handle and get the fire extinguisher, and put the fire out, got the engine feathered. The problem was, I was maximum gross weight. I was headed from Rio de Janeiro to Brazil, in northern Natal, Brazil, on the north coast. And so I was maximum gross weight, but I was at sea level. So I got there, got around on one engine and put it back down again. Well, I've lost several engines, so to speak, and four-engine airplane, but that's no problem. If it doesn't burn up on you. Well, I've lost an engine on the airlift, too, several times. But four engines is pretty comfortable. It's not like losing one of two.
Well, and I think there are a lot of people out there saying easy for you to say, and maybe they wouldn't be so confident in that. And you mentioned Rio de Janeiro to Brazil. And I guess the timeline is important on that, because probably a lot of people and all the veterans we have on this show, you know, primarily they served in Europe or they served somewhere in the Pacific. Maybe early on they were in North Africa, maybe up in the Aleutians. But it's not very often that you hear about South America during the World War II era. But that's where you were during that time. Can you explain what you were doing and what the significance of it was?
That was unusual. You know, I put in for fighters and then up in transports. But when they assigned me to South Atlantic Theater, and we were flying supplies from Florida all the way down to Rio de Janeiro. But that was when we had twin-engine airplanes. Then we got the C-54 while I was in Natal, Brazil. We were stationed in Natal, Brazil. I got assigned a C-54 then. And then we started flying out of Natal east to Ascension Island in Africa. And that was a good run. And out of Natal, we would ferry airplanes. If the guys were bringing down a bomber that was going to England to replace aircraft there, they'd go the southern route in the wintertime down to Natal to Ascension Island, then on over to Africa, and then up to England. And sometimes the airplane would break down in Natal. My buddies and I would draw straws to see who got to deliver it to England while the war was going on. But did that a couple of times, and I enjoyed that. I had quite a lot of variety flying out of there, but flew missions mostly to Ascension Island and Africa and back to the States occasionally and as far south as Argentina. It was a challenging environment, nothing like being shot at. Those guys always had my admiration, and I felt kind of left out, you know, in a way, but I was doing what I was told to do, and I did the best job I could.
What about when World War II came to a close? Well, the war in Europe, VE Day. Was that a big deal to you? I mean, here you've been carrying all these supplies, flying all these flights, trying to support this overall effort. When you got that news that Germany had surrendered, did that mean something?
Yeah, I met some of my buddies who were doing the heavy work. We're going to be able to come home. And it was the end of losing some of them. I've lost several buddies that, of course, as everybody has. And I was just grateful for that. And grateful that it was over for them that were doing the heavy-duty stuff. And now they get back and reacquainted with the families and start the new life. Either some stayed in the military and a lot got out. But it was a ton of weight come off your shoulders on behalf of our people in the Army and the Navy and all those that were in harm's way in behalf of freedom. It was just a new world, a new bright world out there.
You know, and as you mentioned that you were thankful for your buddies, I'm thinking back to something you told us a few minutes ago, that when you got assigned to cargo planes, you felt a little left out. Here you had dreamt about flying the fighters and all of that. Looking back now, how do you feel all about that? And does it seem to you like fighters wasn't the plan for you? And if you had been in fighters, you might not be here?
Well, that was always a possibility. So I just don't try and dwell too much on the past and say that's been done and that's the way they want it. And so you accommodate to it. But, you know, you just take the path that you're given. And if you waste time looking in the rearview mirror too long, you miss the turn off on what you might become.
And what he became was a globally revered humanitarian hero. It's time for our first break, but when this special tribute episode of Hometown Heroes continues, we'll hear how Gail Halverson became the Berlin Candy Bomber. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a link to the entire memorial service, and we'll be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales vehicles, parts, and service center. And you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute episode in honor of the Berlin Candy Bomber, Colonel Gail S. Halverson, who passed away February 16th at the age of 101. We first met Colonel Halverson when he was only 95, with the energy and enthusiasm of a 45-year-old. You've already heard him explain how he became a pilot, and many will continue to follow in his flight path through the efforts of the Gail S. Halverson Aviation Education Foundation, and you heard him explain how he ended up in the Army Air Corps during World War II. But the moment that would come to redefine his purpose in life would come during the Berlin airlift. And here's how he explained that chapter of history for us.
It was about 1945 at the end of the war, the way it was set up in Germany, because at the beginning of the war, they cut Germany into two pieces, the East and the West. Russians had, the Soviet Union has the East, and British, French, and Americans had Western Germany. And then the Berlin, the capital, was deep, 110 miles deep inside of East Germany. And Berlin was made up of four sectors, British, French, American, the Soviet sector. So here was an island of freedom, 110 miles deep into Soviet-controlled East Germany. It was a very unusual case. And I went to, stayed in the military. They asked me to stay in after the war, and I stayed in. And in that process, we'd have pilot meetings every month. And we were increasingly warned about the Soviet threat, that they hadn't disarmed like the Allies had disarmed after the war. And they were headed west, and Berlin was in the way. And then we saw the tension escalate, and we knew something was going to happen. And then they shut off all the supplies on the ground and canal system from West Berlin across East Germany to West Germany. We knew that most of the people in West Berlin were women and children, in Berlin as a whole, no matter what. Heavy losses during the war, prisoner wars, and so most of them were women and children. So I neglected to say what I felt right at that moment, because it wasn't friendly after the war, because Conrad Steffen, that I got interested in flying, as soon as Pearl Harbor, he signed up, was trained. He did get fighters. He was trained in P-47s, and he was sent to England to support the bombers over Germany. And about the fourth mission, the Germans shot Conrad down and killed him. So I had a heavy burden with the Germans, and a guilty conscience. I got him started to flying, and I know that he would have done it one way or another anyway. So that was a situation. And what changed totally was knowing the people were different than Hitler, and there were women and children. And so I wanted to do more, feeling I'd left out of the heavier stuff. I wanted to do do more. And I volunteered to join the airlift and was accepted. And I wasn't married by then. And I was stationed at Rhein Main in West Germany and flying into Berlin through the Southern Corridor. The crowd was so heavy during the startup of the airlift that all the barracks were taken. And when I got there, there was just old tar paper shacks that weren't too good. They were just being trying to refurbish some. And there was a barn, a big barn right there in Zeppelinheim, right Rhein Main, that had a loft in the barn, big loft, clean. And being a farm kid, I investigated the barn. It had a good floor, a cement floor under the loft. And so that was better than the old barracks they had. So me and my buddies took our beds up and slept in the barn. But even those conditions, one of my buddies in the barn had bombed Berlin during the war. And I said, how do you feel about this thing? The war's just been over. We've been home 2 years about. Just got, so you come, and he's a family man. So come through the door, and the kids quit asking, who's that guy? You're just getting back to normal life, and then they call you back to feed the former enemy. He'd been shot up over Berlin. Two of his crew members were wounded. He just barely got back to England in time to save their lives. And I said, how do you feel about that? He said, well, looked far off. He said, it's a whole lot better to feed him than it is to kill him. I'm glad to be back. That's the reward a person gets from helping somebody in deep trouble. And a lesson in forgiveness, you know. How that affected, what that burden would have been, almost unbearable. But he was effective on the airlift. He did a great job and rotated in regular time. So attitude, gratitude, and service before self is the kind of thing that the airlift brought out in people and made it possible for them to dedicate their all to it.
And I know you lived it. You flew them all those missions, and you've been talking about it ever since and reenacting it ever since, so it's old hat for you. But for someone who's hearing about the Berlin airlift for the first time, maybe you can explain what one of those missions would have been like, what you did, what you were dropping to the folks who were cut off, and what maybe challenges you faced in the process.
Well, I got over there pretty early during the after the blockade, and I slept in a barn, no water, got a light bulb from the ceiling, go through the mud to eat to the mess hall and get a shower even. And under those conditions, the morale of the guys flying was good. What we did is, first, the requirement was 8,500 tons a day to feed over 2 million people. And for the first month, we had a terrible deficit. Therefore, the schedule was we'd fly 3 round trips into Berlin from Rhein Main and Frankfurt, and then sleep about 8 hours and do it again. So we were flying maximum, flying C-54s like I flew to South Atlantic. That's what the schedule looked like. Now, you might start at night or you might start in the daytime. It was tough kind of getting used to the rhythm of whenever you get there, you go to bed, get after 3 round trips. And the cargo was dried eggs, dried potatoes. Of course, one plane of dried stuff could carry as much as 3 or 4 airplanes if not dehydrated. And, of course, flour. But we also hauled a lot of coal. They'd comment on importance of energy. At the end, there was as much coal flown as there was food stuff. So we had very lucky, in a way, well, never lucky the thing started in the first place, but it's fortunate, is a better word, that it began in the early summer. The weather is the best then in Europe most of the year. If it started in the winter, we'd been in real trouble. But not long after we started flying, and I got there in early July, we got radar. We had ground control radar to help us stay in the quarters, the 10-mile-wide quarters, and on the long-range radar. But better than that was ground controlled approach, GCA. The air bases were Tempelhof in West Berlin, and British bases. The Brits had radar before we did, but the radar was the thing that really saved it. Tegel was the air base in the French sector, and Gatow was the air base in the British sector, and Tempelhof was the air base in the American sector. The thing that really saved the airlift was radar, the approach in bad weather. And later on, we had plenty of that. The ice and snow and fog. And in November of 1948, we had a real rough time. It was the first time we didn't get an increase every month. But we did better in December and January and February than we did in November. But weather was really bad then.
How exhausting was that? And what kept you going? I mean, I imagine it was fulfilling to know that people's lives depend on what you're doing and that you're helping people out that without you aren't going to have help. But do you remember what you felt during that time and what drove you, what motivated you to keep on going?
Well, the thing that motivated me the most, and of course, we were young, gosh sakes, that was good too. When we were land, be in the daytime and not in a blizzard, they'd bring a certain amount of students, young students, out to the airfield. They'd escort them, and not in huge groups, but in separate groups. And see, we'd stand right by the airplane when it was unloaded. They wouldn't let us even go in the terminal building after a while, because when that airplane was ready to go, they wanted you to start the engine right away. So we stayed with the airplane. We didn't go in the building. So they'd come around, and while we were waiting for them to unload the 20,000 pounds of flour, whatever, they'd bring some kids around. And those kids would bring us even a few flowers in the wintertime, or make a toy they made and give to you, and look them in the eye, and they'd courtesy when they left, and give us a vielen Dank for all that you do. And those little girls and little guys look up at you with those eyes, and thank you for my bread. Man, I never, ever had a misgiving about that and being the former enemy. The children, to me, were the thing that wiped away all that anger about shooting down Conrad Stefan and about the atrocities that we knew were going on. And it was a new plate. The gratitude of the children, the just innocence, they were the ones that I remember this being the most motivating of any that we never hesitated to get back and get another load into Berlin. And the Brits were doing the same at Gatow and the French at Tegel. Everybody was doing it. But I think that identified one change factor, it would be the children and their obvious gratitude.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's what inspired that light bulb moment for you that led to the nicknames you carry with you to this day. Where did this idea come from, to use one of these missions to drop candy for the kids?
Well, I got there in early July. As I said, I thought this airlift would be over. Stalin was getting a black eye in the world press. All over Soviets starving, over 2 million people, mostly women and children. He was losing ground. First of all, he thought it would fail. And with a fail, why? Then he'd win. But on one day, I came back from three round trips to Berlin about 9 o'clock in the morning to Rhein-Main, West Germany. I was supposed to go to bed and start flying that night. But my buddy, John Pickering, from Mobile, who came with me, he had an airplane next to mine. Mine was empty coming in. He had one loaded about to go to Berlin. And I said, wow, this thing's going to be over pretty quick. That's how dumb I was. Going to be over pretty quick. I don't have any pictures on the ground in Berlin. I got to go to Berlin. I had a buddy with a Jeep waiting for me. If you ever get here, he says, I'll take you around and show you, get some pictures of this bombed out city. And so I told John, I told my co-pilot, go to bed, and the crew chief, go to bed. I'll be back in time to fly to Berlin. And I'm going to Berlin. And they said, you're crazy. And I said, that's okay, I'm going. So I jumped on with Pickering and went to Berlin. Jeep was there. Before I wanted to go around the city with a Jeep, I wanted to get a picture of the approach. The approach was bad. They had this temple office built in the city, and there were high apartment houses all the way around it. So you had to come over the top or go between them. There's one place you can go between them with radar to get down to land quick enough. And I wanted to get the movies to come popping over those bombed-out buildings. Hiked across the field to the end of the runway. Airplanes coming right over my head, but behind me, and shooting movies of them. All of a sudden, of course, there's barbed wire fence all around to keep the kids off the runway and all the way around the field. And all of a sudden, I noticed 30 kids, about 8 to 15 years old, right at the barbed wire fence on the other side looking at the uniform, and I got it with me right here, the uniform I wore that day at the fence. And those guys, kids, boys and girls, looked at it, and they were friendly. They knew what Stalin was like. They were aunts and uncles in East Berlin, just across the border, no wall. Come back and say, well, you don't have anything to do with these guys. And they knew the difference. These young kids knew the difference. They were cheering me up. Says, now look, this is good weather in July, but when the winter comes, you're going to get ice and snow, and it's going to be hard to get in here. But when that happens, don't worry about us. We don't need enough to eat. Just give us a little. Someday we'll have enough to eat, but if we lose our freedom, we'll never get it back. Kids, 8 to 40, some been probably in the Hitler Youth, some of them, and yet they knew the difference between freedom and having a managed government, going to manage your life. So those kids just blew my mind. They talked to me for about 45 minutes or almost an hour, and I said, I got to go. I had the Jeep waiting for me, take me around town. I said, don't worry about it. We'll never give up on you. Good to see you. Most of them spoke English. There's some English, and we had a translator, a kid that translated too. He says, don't worry, we never give up, and took off. Got about 50 yards, and a voice came to me, clear as a bell, you know. Wow, that was interesting. How come? And then it came to me immediately. It's the first time during the war and after that I've flown in a foreign country, the kids that age hadn't mobbed you. There's an American uniform, that's a soft touch. They got chocolate or gum, and they'd grab you going down the street in different countries. Since George Washington, troops going down the street in a different place, handing out candy to kids, that's nothing different. That's been forever. George Washington's troops did the same thing. But then when it hit me was, they had me stop dead, and not by voice inflection or body language or even any clue did they say, don't you know we like kids like chocolate? We don't have any chocolate. For a couple of years, we don't have any chocolate where we could just go buy it. And when I realized that not one child had broke ranks and they were so grateful for a flower to be free, they wouldn't be a beggar for more, it blew my mind. I just couldn't. And I said, holy cow. So I thought, I hope I got something. And I reached in my pocket hurriedly, and I found us two sticks of Wrigley's Double Mint Gum. And I hesitated a minute, and I took off again.
And what happened next would spark the legend of Uncle Wackelflügel, Uncle Wiggly Wings in German. You'll hear it in his words as we continue to honor the legacy of Gail Halvorsen, who has finished his earthly assignment at the age of 101. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma, you can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit, and don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a tribute episode today in honor of Colonel Gail S. Halverson, the Berlin Candy Bomber, who passed away February 16th at the age of 101. What an incredible legacy he leaves, not just the school in Germany that bears his name or the Gail S. Halverson Aviation Education Foundation that will continue to change futures, but that legacy rests largely in a simple example of kindness that really did change the world. When we left off, he was at the fence with all those German children during the Berlin airlift. All he had in his pocket was two sticks of gum, and he really didn't want to incite some kind of riot.
I said, two sticks, you're going to have bloody noses. Get out of here. Two sticks is not going to make any difference, and they're just going to get these kids with a bloody nose. I got about 50 feet of that, and the voice clears a bell. Just no equivocation. Go back to the fence. Just like a command. I hear that voice now. No hesitation. Go back to the fence. Well, I turned around, and when I did, those kids just grabbed the barbed wire and waited. And I got there, and I pulled it out, and boy, they watched every move, broke it in half, and passed to the kids that did some of the translating, and here come the rush. And I, oh, dear, be careful. All the little girls, and they were kind. They asked for a piece of the wrapper, and the kids that got a half a stick carefully tore off the outer wrapper and the tin foil. I stood there, dumbfounded, and passed out the strips of paper to the other kids that didn't get any gum. And the kids would put that up to their nose and smell it. And I turned to leave. They had it crumpled up in their hand to take back to show mother, if she still, or if dad, with dad, not too many dads, to show them what they found at the fence that day in Berlin, a piece of wrapper on a half a stick of gum. When I saw that, it just blew my mind. I said, boy, for 50 cents, I could put on an easy street, give them a full stick of gum to keep the wrapper. And then the red light came on. Well, you should be in bed now. I had a good co-pilot. I should have been in bed in Rhein-Main that moment. But I had a great co-pilot, John Pickering, and I knew he could find his way to Berlin. I'd be awake that time. So instead of going to bed, I went back. Had to go back and start flying. Anyway, those kids, just unbelievable in their attitude and gratitude. So that's how it started there.
Well, and I'm sure you had no idea what it was going to turn into and how big a deal it would become. I mean, here you just have this innocent idea, and you talk about hearing voices in your head. You think that was lack of sleep, or do you have some other explanation for that?
I'm belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We call that the Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost rides with you and helps you, prompts you what path to take, and that where you end up is if you follow the GPS of the Holy Ghost, then you're going to end up in a pretty good place. So. Well, I did. I got in trouble. I came back the next day over the field, and they said, how do we know what airplane you're in? And there's an airplane every 5 minutes, and we'll be tired if you don't get in soon. And I said, when I came over the field, I wiggle the wings. Wiggle the wings like I did over the farm when I got my pilot license. Showed Dad that was me. My dog, I had a black shepherd dog, and he'd chase airplanes. And I see my dog chasing my airplane from down below. But... So he said, I'll wiggle the wings and that'll know that I'm there. And that's how we communicated first.
How much candy did you end up dropping? And how amazed were you when you saw the impact that it had on awareness, not just there in Germany, but around the world, and what kind of dent that made?
Well, I started out with two sticks of gum, and it ended up, we couldn't buy much chocolate. All we could was ration. And so we could buy just so much every week. And so my buddies gave me their ration. And then for 3 weeks, we dropped it. And the crowd got bigger and bigger and bigger. Came back from Berlin one day to Rhein-Main. An officer met the airplane. Come steaming on board. He said, who's flying this airplane? My buddy pointed to me. He is. Why? Colonel Hahn wants to see you right now. What for? He'll tell you what for. Colonel Hahn and Halverson. I flew for him in Mobile, and he came over too. A lieutenant colonel, a head boss. And he says, Halverson, well, what have you been doing? I said, flying like mad, sir. I'm not stupid, he said. What else you been doing? And then I knew he knew. He pulled out of the newspaper, threw it on the counter, German Berlin paper, right on the front page of my airplane. Parachutes coming out of it. Kids lined up the barbed wire fence. I said, holy cow. Oh, Halverson, why didn't you tell me about that? He says, Sir, there's no excuse. I had Utah State. I had two quarters of ROTC. There's no excuse for an act like that. No excuse, sir. So he said, well, General Tunner called me up. The big boss, General Tunner, called him up and said, Hon, what have you been doing dropping parachutes over Berlin? Old General, you know we're not dropping anywhere Berlin. We're unloading all the coal and food on the ground. They got an unloading crews. We wouldn't drop it over, pulverize it, or hit somebody. We're unloading it. He said, Colonel, you better find out what's going on in your outfit. Clunk. What I found out from that in my military career is don't try and impress your boss's boss. Work on your boss. Well, I didn't want to impress anybody. I didn't want anybody to know about it. So that's how I found out about it. And then we went crazy. The guys in the States sent stuff. All the schools sent things to Chicopee, Massachusetts. They tied up everything and sent it over ready to drop. So the candy companies, Hershey was the biggest one, that they'd say, how much of this you want? And we'd give them some ridiculous number, and they sent it. So we sent it up to Chicopee, and then the school kids from all around the area, Chicopee, Mass, would come in and tie up these things in big cardboard boxes and put them on the airplanes going over from Westover Air Force Base, over the Rhine Main, and then we would lock it up and load it up with my buddies to give them a map of how to find it and how to different places so we didn't drop it all the same place. But that's how we distributed that much candy. It was 23 tons. 20 tons dropped in that time, and 5 tons at Christmas time distributed on the ground to the Christmas parties on the ground. The ultimate sacrifice was 31 Americans that were killed during the blockade and 39 Brits that gave their lives to the former enemy.
Yeah, and who's to say you wouldn't have become one of them, but instead what you became was a legendary figure, especially in Germany. When you finished that tour over there, when the blockade had ended and some kind of normalcy was restored and you headed back to the States, was it hard to fathom just how big a deal this was and how that one little idea and those two sticks of gum turned into such a worldwide phenomenon?
I never did. I still don't understand it. I still don't understand it. Small things precede that, which is great, and it was a very small thing. I couldn't be more grateful for all the great, wonderful support, the schools all over the United States. Without them, we wouldn't have those parachutes to use. Grateful for the support of the children, the American children. And I've had letters from kids that lost their dad in the war in Germany. And yet they said that as bad as they felt, they thought it was a healing influence. But one thing I've taken from this is that fulfillment in life doesn't come from more money or a newer car or a bigger house than a neighbor. And the real fulfillment comes from serving others. The Dead Sea's dead because it wraps its arms around all the fresh water that comes in and gives out nothing. And wherever you live, United States or other places, you'll find Dead Sea souls. When they said, first of all, if somebody is in need, they say, well, what did you give me? Find out what the reward will be before the act. And that cuts off the real blessing, the greater blessing. So service before self is the antidote. Service before self, you see the need, do what one can without question for the maximum benefit, maximum reward. The other thing is gratitude. Gratitude is the elixir that breaks down barriers between people. It shows a consideration for somebody besides yourself. And showing that gratitude, like the children, is silent gratitude. Their lack of saying, gimme, gimme, their silent gratitude was more powerful than a verbal one. Gratitude, attitude, service before self, and small decision. Like I said, put your footsteps on the path at least to where you end up, for good or bad. Those are the things that the airlift taught me and affected my life, has for since that time and still does. It changed hatred to friendship.
What an incredible story. What an incredible man. Gail Halvorsen, the Berlin Candy Bomber. At hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a link to the entire memorial service for him this week in Utah, attended by foreign diplomats and American top brass alike. Before we're done on the radio today, I'd like you to hear the remarks from retired 4-star Air Force General Duncan McNabb, sharing his perspective on this one-of-a-kind American hero.
I'm a longtime air mobility kind of person, and we lived with the legend of the Berlin Airlift and the Candy Bomber. And whenever you talked about what airlift could do and how we could bring, you know, happiness to the world and hope to people. It always came up, this is what we did in Berlin. This is what we did in the Berlin Airlift. And then what Gail Halvorsen did on bringing the American people and the German people together and our countries together the way they did. Later on, I had a chance to be the commander of the Air Mobility Command and then the U.S. Transportation Command, which commands all those mobility forces, both airlift and air refueling that you see go around the world, and obviously they're very busy today, as you could imagine. But part of that was we would have an Airlift Tanker Association convention every year that we would bring all of the people in mobility together and talk about what they did and how well they did it. And they're kind of behind the scenes. They do stuff around the world every day. And Gail always would come and be part of that ATA convention. And he would speak, and he would do seminars, and he would spend time with the young people and inspire them. And you just watched what it meant to them and what it meant to him. One of the times that I really got to see Gail's impact around the world is I was asked to go to Berlin for the 60th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift with Gail. And I would tell you, you've never been around a rock star more than Gail Halvorsen in Berlin during the anniversary of the Berlin Airlift. It was just amazing to see how he was adored. And I still remember, you know, the crowd kind of, you know, opening up as Chancellor Merkel came through the crowd to him to say thank you. You know, you think about what that meant. I recall remarks from Chaplain Baldwin, who at the Air Force Memorial said these words. He says, "When it is dark, the stars come out. Stars are always present. You just can't see them all the time." And it is absolutely true in the tragic moments of human history when brave women and men are called to fight against the darkness of aggression and terrorism, the stars come out. And when it is the darkest is when the stars really come out, are the brightest. Just think about how dark it was for the folks in West Berlin as the blockade came in, as the Russians came across Europe and instituted that blockade, and how dark it was for them. And that we turned, because we didn't have many other options, to say, we're going to use airlift to resupply the city and bring them food and bring them coal so that they are warm. And Gail went a little further on that and was inspired by the kids and decided that during those missions, he would start dropping candy to them. And you all have heard those stories. And you know, you relate to all those stories. And I remember I got to go with, when I was the Air Mobility Command commander, we dedicated a dining hall to her, to Gail. And basically, as we go through there, we met with the airmen, and he's telling stories, I'm telling stories, and he says, can I tell you one other story? And he told us about one of those young people that got one of his candy. And when he went back to Tempelhof as a colonel, as the commander, that young person now was grown up and came through the line. And when he got to Colonel Halvorsen, he said, "Sir, I just want to thank you for saving my life." He said, when I was an orphan when the Berlin airlift hit, and all around me was devastation. And now they've cut off food and cut off water. And one of your, I was totally hopeless. I was devastated. And one of your pieces of candy happened to fall close to me. And Colonel Halvorsen, I didn't eat that piece of candy. I put it under my pillow." He said, "Because you can live on very little food and very little water, but without hope, your soul dies." He says, "And your candy meant to me that somebody out there was trying to help me and cared about me, and it gave me hope. Without without hope, your soul dies." I remember hearing that, and all these young airmen, and I just went, I said, "Can I use that whenever I talk to people?" Because it is such a great message, and that's the kind of life that he lived. He changed the world in big ways and small ways. His actions did fundamentally change the relationships between two great countries. We became great allies from that. But in small ways, it was in all the people that he touched, all the people that he saw and he inspired. And I think about, you know, one of the things that, you know, you look at how he was. It was his compassion, it was his love, it was his kindness. But you know, it was also his joy of life, his absolute joy of life. Whenever you're around him, big smile on his face, he was always up. And that joy really reflected a couple of things. And I would just tell you, one was his tremendous love for his family. And every time you see it, you'd see how much he loved his family and then how much you loved him. And I want to thank the whole family for sharing Gail with mankind. You all did that, and I know that wasn't easy. I mean, I just saw how much he was in demand and how much he gave. It was just, you know, totally inspiring. And so as I think about, I think about what that means, I just want to say thank you. The second thing that I would tell you, to just give you an example of what it was like, is at one of those Airlift Tanker Association conventions, I was the AMC commander, and I surprised Gail, who was in the very back of the auditorium, probably had 3,000 people there, and here he is, he's in his mid to late 80s, and I said, something that has never been given is the campaign banner for Operation Vittles, you know, for what he did. And so Gail Halverson, come on down. And he ran from the very back all the way up, jumped up on the stage, had the biggest smile on his face, and everybody's going, I think he really liked this. This was really good. But it was that joy of life that you would see that inspired so many people. And I would just say, he was one of those really, truly great, beautiful stars that we were talking about early on, when the darkness comes. And he was a once-in-the-generation figure, a dear friend. And he is one of those people that made our beacon of hope for mankind will shine on, just as it is, has been done for generations before and will be in generations to come. He was one of those lights that you would look at and go, this is the way you live life and make a difference. And he sure made a difference to us. Thank you very much.
Retired Air Force General Duncan McNabb with his tribute this week to the late Gail Halverson, the Berlin Candy Bomber, who before passing away at age 101, recorded a little video. In it, he reads a poem he wrote in the cockpit way back in 1946. His imagination then capturing a reality he surely understands with even more clarity now. He called it, Nearer, My God, to Thee.
Soaring through the clouds, I half expect here to see an angel dining next to me, a table here, a table there, or perhaps a place for a rocking chair. This room is furnished and replete. The floor is soft for angels' feet. You've seen the shows and the carpets lined with a film of cloud that trails behind. This is it, and first and now. You see the light in the marble hall. The doors are wispy, never slam. They haven't yet replaced the jam. For pictures, you may raise a call, but watch those rainbows on the wall. They change around and hang on straight. No worry of plaster or adhesive tape. The maker of all this must be near. Some greater presence calms my fears. How insignificant this machine and man in such a great and marvelous plan. I leave the room. Now down the street, the angels at this lamppost meet. You'd think that life was on the ground, till high and free you wandered loose. To watch the spires and taunt the goose, to feel the breeze and taste the air that stars and years have heaped up there. To turn the earth upon its side, then put the nose down in a dive. To put the gear against the clouds, and leave the heights within their shrouds, that another day may come, and the ascent up once more begun, until that day when he will call, and stall the wings that never stall.
That day finally came for Gail Halvorsen on February 16th, but this won't be the last time his incredible legacy is celebrated. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a YouTube link to the entire memorial service, as well as how to connect with the Gail S. Halvorsen Aviation Education Foundation. We're out of time for now, but I hope you can join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.